You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 17 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we begin today with a celebration.
You hear what that sound is? That's the sound of a cool, tasty Coors Light in celebration of the Boulevard Park Murders winning their fifth fantasy football championship and repeating for a second time.
Again, the Coors Light Silver Bullet Boss Trophy belongs to Tristan.
Thank you.
Congrats.
It's what we all play for. It's what I've been working for since August, studying, researching. You know, fantasy football is a year-round sport now. And I'm very excited to hoist the trophy over my head once again.
And
with that, I'll be enjoying my first Coors Light in a very long time. I see that it's cold, not necessarily super cold. And I'd like to give a special shout-out and thank you to the players that have helped me reach this point. A shout-out to Russell Wilson, Noshawn Moreno, LeSean McCoy, Demaryius Thomas, Jordy Nelson, Jimmy Graham, Julian Edelman, who came in and helped out in the playoffs, Dan Bailey, who helped me to advance to the finals, the Chiefs defense, which was huge all season long, Lamar Miller, who played.
Was on your roster.
Shane Vereen, Andre Brown, who helped out for a few weeks, Alex Smith, who filled in when Russell Wilson was on bye. It was a huge season. Thank you so much to all of those guys. And I'm really excited to be accepting my fifth Coors Light Silver Bullet Boss Trophy.
It's a pretty impressive run.
It's the most impressive run. We're talking Ditka-like run. I was 1 year away from a five-peat. I won two and then lost one, and now I've won two in a row.
But this was a touch and go. Through the first week of the finals, we do two-week playoff rounds and go all the way through week 17, which maybe is not the best idea. But
that's refreshing, Coors Light.
I was trying to tell you. through week one, you were down in the finals.
Down 12. And then I came back with a massive second week of the fantasy football playoffs and ended up winning by a pretty significant margin, 224 to 188. But a good showing by Nick and the SeaTac Shit Geese. They had a great season. And, you know, I think they were really deserving. I was really excited to play them and to meet the second best in the finals.
Well, my personal goal being long out of the playoffs and in the consolation bracket was to try to outscore as many people who were in the actual playoffs as possible. And I feel like I did pretty well there. I got a 195 over the last 2 weeks, which is no great shakes, but was better than Nick.
Yeah, it doesn't quite match up with the 224.
But it would have finished tied for second out of the four playoff teams.
Well, that's really, really impressed. Good job.
I wish the season was a little bit longer. I feel like we just ran out of time for our playoff run.
Yeah, your team.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's talk about a real playoff run, as the Seattle Seahawks yesterday defeat the St. Louis Rams to clinch the number one seed.
That was good. A little touch and go in the first half of that performance. The offense getting off to a slow start. At one point, 14 consecutive third downs they failed to pick up. But the defense came through with one of its better performances of the season, I think. Contributed a touchdown, held St. Louis for negative rushing yards most of the game, and then the offense eventually got clicking in the second half to turn it into a blowout.
Yeah, it was really cool at the end of the game, or I guess I suppose in the third quarter, and I actually heard Paul Silvey mention this last night, but you looked up at the board that shows the rushing leaders, and to see St. Louis at negative one rushing yards. During the game it seemed like they were shutting it down, but not quite that much. And it was so different from what St. Louis did to Seattle in St. Louis, and how they absolutely just destroyed Zach Stacy in this game.
I think it shows the growth of the Seattle defense, particularly that linebacking core, but also the defensive line had a phenomenal game. Tony McDaniel was in the backfield making plays time and time again, behind the line of scrimmage.
It was one of the best games from Tony McDaniel, Clint McDonald, but Bobby Wagner had a hell of a game.
Yeah.
And then also Malcolm Smith coming up with that pick six to begin the game, and a pretty good catch for a linebacker that Smith made over his head and then taking it to the house. That kind of set the tone, and it felt like, okay, we scored first, this is the way it's going to go, you know?
The secondary really wasn't even tested. St. Louis couldn't protect Kellen Clemens enough to throw deep that off, and the couple of times they did, The cornerbacks came through. Obviously, a very nice pick by Byron Maxwell, who continues to solidify himself as the starter opposite Richard Sherman.
Yeah, it was unfortunate that Sherman didn't come up with a pick or a pick six or something that was really significant to continue his defensive player of the year run. And maybe Earl Thomas, one of those guys, could have maybe sealed that up this game.
Well, can we talk about that for a second?
In the defensive player of the year or the Seahawks defense in general?
Defensive player of the year, because the national perspective seems to be that Earl Thomas is the best defender of the Seahawks. You listen to Bill Barnwell, Aaron Schatz, you know, experts like that. I think a lot of the people in the TV media, and they generally put Earl Thomas as the best defensive player of the year candidate on the Seahawks, whereas I feel like locally it's a pretty strong consensus that Sherman is the better candidate.
Absolutely. And Sherman has the one notable stat in the picks. I don't know if he tied for the league lead in interceptions, but he's got the one stat that you can look at. I mean, Earl Thomas had the high level of play consistently throughout the season, but to me, Richard Sherman was clearly, and he's a better defender from watching the season, the team all season.
Sherman ended up the only guy with 8 picks. No one else had more than
so
6.
So alone with the most picks by 2 picks. So he has the signature stat. I mean, people mention Robert Quinn with the signature stat sacks, but picks are harder to get, especially when people aren't throwing at you as often. He's got the pick six coming against Houston that basically won that game and that everybody saw. And then also, if you look at the Seahawks defense throughout the year.
Number one defense in the league. So I think that's probably the first place you should start to look for candidates is on the number one defense. I think that's a pretty good way to do it. I can't quite put my finger on what the difference is between the national perspective on the Sherman-Thomas situation versus the local.
There might be some sort of prejudice against Richard Sherman for being so outspoken.
And I think maybe it's, you know, a belief that you don't want to have that kind of simple perspective, oh, he's got a lot of interceptions, he must be the best defender. But I think when you watch him on a play-to-play basis like we do, you see that he just takes away his half of the field.
And it's not selling out to get picks.
No, not at all. Not taking bad risks. He's oftentimes just running the route better than the man he's covering, which makes you wonder whether with the injuries at wide receiver, he shouldn't be thrown out there from time to time.
It would be really exciting to see him play wide receiver.
I mean, Earl Thomas, I think the one negative is sometimes he does overrun in run pursuit. That's what led to the Frank Gore touchdown, or not touchdown run, but
yeah,
the
to
long
me, that's
run.
That's kind of a signature negative play that Earl Thomas had that Richard Sherman doesn't have throughout the season. There was no one player where it's like, wow, Richard Sherman really got burned there. He had one last year in the playoffs against Atlanta where Sherman really got burned by, I think, Roddy White, maybe Julio Jones. But that hasn't really happened this year where there was one big play where it's like, wow, they really got Sherman there. On that play in San Francisco, Earl Thomas just completely approached that play wrong. Frank Gore juked him, and Earl Thomas is falling over.
I mean, it's one play, and the Seahawks run defense has been very good, as we've talked about during the second half of the season. But I think that if there is an area where he struggles a little bit at times, it's making open field tackles is not his strength.
But as far as looking at the defensive player of the year in general, you have a team who's finished 7th best defense of all time per Football Outsiders DVOA. You have to give somebody credit from that defense.
And I think that's the difficult thing when it comes to the actual voting, is that those two guys will probably split the honors.
I'll be curious to see. I still feel like one of them will win. I feel fairly confident that one of them will win.
I would be surprised by it. I think I don't know who's going to win. I mean, it's a wide open award this year. There's no J.J. Watt from last year.
But so the Seahawks finished this year with the best defensive points allowed per game ever at 14.4.
In franchise history.
Not ever.
I think there were some early seasons before the forward pass.
Teams were playing a pretty good defense. And then also the best point differential in franchise history at plus 186.
Yeah, it was basically a capper of a phenomenal regular season, and it was nice to see the Seahawks pull away like they did, because there was so much fretting in Seattle about, oh, what's wrong with the offense, you know, we're going into the playoffs on a down note. And I think that the second half yesterday just kind of erased all of that and reminded everyone, hey, this is a really amazing team whose regular season should be celebrated.
And it was nice to see Golden Tate make a really athletic play and to see the wide receivers make a big play, because it'd been tough going for the wide receivers the last couple weeks.
Absolutely, and that showed up again in the third down situation. And the Seahawks started to do a better job. We saw a lot more creativity, I think, out of Darrell Bevell's play calls and managing the pressure, and the fact that Robert Quinn basically treated Russell Okung, unfortunately, like a turnstile yesterday.
I don't know if it was that bad.
It was pretty bad. I don't know if you could tell how bad it was in the stadium.
But then seeing Brian Walters on the field so much throughout that game was really strange.
Yeah, I think he stepped into Jermaine Kearse's role. Not obviously he stepped in as the third receiver, literally, but also in terms of the guy who they called on to run block from the edge. And there was a lot of run blocking because the Seahawks tried very hard to establish the run earlier in the game.
He did not get a target all game.
Yeah.
Even though he played a significant portion of the game. So that was kind of surprising to see him in there. But the offense, there are still some concerns going to the playoffs. Despite the fact that per Football Outsiders DVOA, this is the fifth best team of all time overall. And the only team ever to finish in the top 10 offensively, defensively, and in special teams. So probably one of the most
They were the third team ever to do that in consecutive years.
Oh, in consecutive years.
Yeah, yeah.
But so looking at one of the most complete teams that has ever existed.
Okay. Yeah, I mean.
Right? But there's still concerns about the offense going forward. Finding rhythm was really hard yesterday. They ran the ball a lot with Lynch, but he still didn't find a lot of traction there.
I think he did. From the second quarter onward, those holes started to open up. They really were effective. But yeah, it was a commitment to the run. I believe the first seven or eight first down plays they had were all runs until the last drive of the first half, just outside the two-minute warning. That was the first time they passed on first down. So that shows you something we talked about last week on the podcast, that anytime the Seahawks have a rough week running the football, they really want to get back to that identity the following week. But I think also an opportunity where, you know, you start to hit play action on those first down plays a little bit more, mix things up, then I think you can have potentially some more success early in game.
They definitely wanted to build up that confidence there in Marshawn and to instill that they were going to run the ball and this is their identity. I think Pete was concerned that they lost some of that identity as a running team.
Absolutely.
It was interesting to see that Russell basically did not run the ball himself all game. One run of 8 yards, but nothing else outside of that.
Well, I think that makes sense in a Week 17 game. The number one thing you want is, let's get out of this game healthy. And the worst moment of the game by far, well, there was two of them. Number one was the almost interception where Kellen Clemens just lobbed up a pop-up. It was basically like flyers up in the end zone, and three Seahawks collided trying for the pick. I wish they would have called it, because that could have been Sherman's ninth pick of the season, yep. Or Thomas's, another pick for him. But in Sherman down for a while, he returned to the game, he turned out to be fine, but that was a heart new
that play. Was really, really sure. Scary.
And then unfortunately, Luke Wilson was injured, suffered a high ankle sprain, had to be carted off the field wearing an air cast.
We'll see how that goes. It's nice getting the extra week to see if he can recover. But I was thinking maybe if there's anybody out there that the Seahawks would pick up, you wouldn't really feel that confident with Kellen Davis in there as your second tight end.
No, you'd want more of a receiving threat from that.
And as somebody who's going to be receiving. I thought to myself, I wish the Falcons could release Tony Gonzalez right now.
Well, you know what I was wondering about is Anthony McCoy. We're 7 months removed from his ruptured Achilles during OTAs. I haven't heard any talk about that,
but he's on IR, right?
He got waived by the Seahawks, okay. So he could potentially
come back. So they could bring him
back. But I have no idea. It's a 6 to 9 month rehab process. He suffered that injury, I think, about a month after Kobe Bryant did. So that gives you a sense of the timeline. We're less than a month from Kobe Bryant returning and a couple weeks out from Kobe Bryant re-injuring himself after struggling. So it's a bit of a stretch, but that was
he's
going to
commit a lot of turnovers.
That was one thought that I had.
I would expect them to go out if it looks like Luke Wilson is not going to be healthy, probably either way at this
point. I'd be surprised if he's able to come back. I mean, high ankle sprains usually a 4-week process.
Potentially, if they were playing in February, there would be a chance. But in the thing that we don't speak of.
And we have to be careful not to speak of it, because there's a lot of presumptuousness among yes. Seahawks fans right now. And I am very bothered by this. If we've learned anything from being Seattle sports fans over the course of our lives, it's never to get too excited prematurely.
Yeah, failure will happen. Pain will happen to you.
There's a very long, disturbing history of Seattle sports teams having great regular seasons and collapsing in the playoffs. The 94 Sonics against Denver. The 2001 Mariners, who won 116 games in the regular season in the ALCS. So I have declared a moratorium on using the S word.
The SB word.
Yes.
So let's talk about the games that are definitely going to happen. In 2 weeks, the Seahawks will be playing on Saturday, January 11th at 1:35. And let's talk about, so there are three teams who they can possibly play in that game. They cannot play the Philadelphia Eagles, because if they win, they would automatically play against Carolina.
Yes.
So the three teams are, in reverse order of where they finished, the New Orleans Saints, who played here not too long ago, and the Seahawks beat pretty easily.
4 weeks ago today.
The San Francisco 49ers, who the Seahawks lost to 2 weeks ago. And then also the Green Bay Packers, who just got Aaron Rodgers and Randall Cobb back. Let's talk about those teams individually and who we'd want to play and what we think it would look like if we played them.
To me, the weakest of those teams is still the Green Bay Packers. You know, they did come up with the win they needed on the road yesterday against the Chicago Bears in what it was a de facto playoff game between those two teams. But they also struggled defensively with Chicago. You know, they got bailed out by Aaron Rodgers, basically. I still don't think that I think they're the least complete of those three teams.
Man. Green Bay is just so scary to me. I know I mentioned this to you that all three of those teams who could potentially play here will have played at CenturyLink in the last two seasons. The Seahawks will have beaten them all, San Francisco twice pretty easily. Green Bay was the hardest of those four games, and the Fail Mary game. The Seahawks basically lost that. The Seahawks aren't the same team that they were when that happened, but Green Bay still scares me more than a team like New Orleans does. I think the simplicity with which the Seahawks beat New Orleans a few weeks ago makes it hard to not want to play them again.
I mean, I think you can overstate what happened in that one game, but obviously New Orleans has struggled outdoors, they've struggled on the road, and those are both scenarios that are going to take place if they come here. So
most likely be cold weather. And New Orleans, in a bit of a way, has kind of gone into a downward spiral since that game. They haven't been playing particularly efficiently. They haven't been playing particularly consistently since then. Drew Brees hasn't looked great. They had a really rough game at Carolina in weather.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. But still, if you look at those teams head-to-head, is Green Bay better offensively than New Orleans? I don't know that they are. I mean, maybe you could make the argument that because of the conditions they are. And New Orleans has been a much better defensive team over the course of the season than Green Bay. I mean, Clay Matthews isn't walking through that door.
So to your argument here, if you look at Football Outsiders DVOA, Green Bay was still the ninth best offense with Matt Flynn in there for most of that time period. The 31st defense.
That's bad. Ranking, there's only 32 teams.
And Green Bay is probably the worst playoff team at 21st overall.
Although obviously much better in looking strictly at the games that Rodgers played.
But then you have New Orleans, who is the number 4 team overall. The number 4 offense, number 5 offense, number 10 defense, a pretty consistent team. It was just how simple it was for the Seahawks to beat New Orleans a few weeks ago and in that weather. But I suppose after looking at this, I might be feeling more positively about Green Bay.
Now, how do you fit San Francisco in here? A team that has been proven able to win close games over the Seahawks at home has struggled its last two trips to CenturyLink Field.
San Francisco is the team who I would like to beat the most. I know that the all-time record between the two teams is 15 versus 15, so it'd be nice to take the lead in that. However, they're the team that scares me the most also.
Yeah, I think even though they, as badly as they've played in their trips to Seattle, you know, I think that they're the team that I would rather face an offensive team.
Yes.
Than a team that's going to play a low-scoring defensive style. I mean, even if Kaepernick has another bad game, and he's obviously struggled the last two times he's come to Seattle, a week ago we saw the Arizona Cardinals win in a game where Carson Palmer threw 4 interceptions, and I don't think Kaepernick can possibly be worse than that. Well, maybe. But anyway, the point is, San Francisco could play that same style where their defense shuts everything down and a couple of special teams errors, and that's how you pull an upset.
And that game at San Francisco a few weeks ago, the way that they took away everything that the Seahawks wanted to do, especially taking away Russell running, Russell rolling out, I think was really scary.
So we'll see. Which team do you think is the most likely to come to Seattle?
I think it's probably San Francisco.
I tend to agree. I mean, that's what the lines will imply. You know, Philadelphia is a slight favorite over New Orleans. They're playing the best football down the stretch of any of these teams, so I would expect to see the Eagles take care of business at home. And then the 49ers are a slight favorite going on the road into Green Bay.
Yeah, I think it's most likely them. It'll be scary. It'll be exciting playing San Francisco again. The whole climate around it will be more exciting than playing against Green Bay or New Orleans. But they're the team who I'd be most afraid of losing to.
I mean, any of those is going to be a good, very compelling TV matchup. I mean, you know, Green Bay brings the national fan base that they have. You know, New Orleans very popular. It's going to be a good style of game.
The NFC playoffs go six deep, especially with Aaron Rodgers and Randall Cobb coming back for Green Bay. I wouldn't be feeling too confident if I was San Francisco right now. They're the one team who can take away what Green Bay wants to do. And also, San Francisco is kind of in Green Bay's head after those two losses.
I think so. It'll be interesting to see what happens. We saw them struggle with the read option in last year's playoffs, then spend you know, the next 9 months, basically, working on the read option. And San Francisco comes out and throws the ball all over the field against them in week one of the season.
And they have a better passing attack now than they did then with Crabtree coming back.
Yeah, so we'll see. Does that mean they go back to the read option in this playoff game?
You would hope between those two that they expend so much energy on each other because they're rivals in their own right. And they might even be bigger rivals a little bit. There's no real verbal sparring in the same way that there is between Clay Matthews and Colin Kaepernick.
I don't think the same kind of hatred between the coaches.
But you would hope that they expend so much energy on that first-round game that they don't have the same kind of preparation for the second-round game.
Yeah, and that's going to be something interesting to watch. We can talk more about this, I think, next week. But I'm curious to see what the Seahawks do offensively with these couple weeks off, whether they put a few new wrinkles in there. Now, that could be Percy Harvin, depending on how his hip recovers, although I'm certainly not counting on seeing him on the field again this season. But I think it also could be a return to some more read option than we've seen recently.
Do you also think there'll be a factor, because a lot of coaches were fired, and assumedly Daryl Bevel will be interviewing for some jobs, Dan Quinn also is going to be interviewing for some jobs, that they might not have the same ability to insert these things if he's out interviewing and preparing for interviews?
Yeah, I'm not too worried about that. I think that always happens this time of year when your team is successful. And, you've got 2 weeks of practice. If you're gone a day, I think there's still plenty of time to devote to that. And also Pete Carroll will handle all of it since he doesn't sleep.
He really doesn't.
Neither Russell nor Russell Wilson.
Driving by the VMAC, I'm like, Pete Carroll's in there right now working.
I mean, the story last week about Pete Carroll getting in there at 4:45 the morning after the loss to Arizona, and Russell already having beaten him in there. That's, you feel good about your team when you hear stories like that.
He just couldn't sleep after the loss. I don't blame him. So you want to talk about the Huskies this last week? They beat BYU to get to 9 wins. A really exciting victory for UW. What'd you see there?
We will always remember our Fight Hunger Bowl triumph yeah. to conclude this season. No, a really good performance from the Huskies. There was a situation where you wouldn't have been stunned if they had had a flat performance after all of the turmoil of the last month with Steve Sarkisian's departure and the arrival of Chris Peterson, who wasn't even at the game as he's putting together his staff. But Marcus Tuiasosopo stepped in as the interim head coach. I think we were all excited to see Tui on the sidelines guiding the team, and he did an admirable job and led them to victory.
It's a little bit bittersweet with the news that he's headed to USC as the tight ends coach. I think it's probably bittersweet for him to be the head guy for a little while and then to go back to be the tight ends coach for his former boss. But it was one of those games where I think that UW's veteran leadership was really great, having Keith Price around and having a pretty veteran team. I know that they have a lot of juniors, not necessarily a lot of seniors on the team, but they have a lot of players who've been around for a long time, and they kind of just, they were just better than BYU in every capacity. All the distractions that happened, they may have been distracted. You know, the offense didn't move that smoothly. Bishop Sankey didn't have the best game of his career.
I mean, I don't think that was surprising given what we knew about the BYU defense. The game pretty much played out, I think, as we expected, maybe a little bit more higher scoring than I anticipated. But the difference in the game proved to be something we talked about, which is BYU's terrible special teams. And the Huskies get a 100-yard kickoff return from John Ross, another big return from Jesse Callier later on in the game. And that really swung it. The offensive stats were very similar between the two teams. The special teams, I think you could argue, was the deciding factor.
It's true, and BYU outgained UW. During the game, but the BYU...
Partially because I believe they ran 850 plays, somewhere did. Around there.
BYU is not particularly bad in kicking or punting, but their coverage is so terrible that this is something that they allow to happen. And when you're a team that plays really tight defense, you basically can't give up these long returns. Good defensive teams need to be good special teams teams.
Yeah, there's a synergy there, which I think is something we do see with the Seahawks. But the UW defense... Taysom Hill had more success, I think, than we expected, especially in the first half, but they did a terrific job.
They limited Taysom Hill running the ball a little bit, and he only averaged 4 yards per carry, although while watching it felt like he was averaging a million yards per carry.
And the running backs got very little on the ground. They combined for less than 50 yards as a group, their running backs.
And they did especially well against Jamal Williams. Yeah, 12 carries for 31 yards at just 2.6 yards per carry. The defense played really great.
A shutout after halftime.
I think that in general, the Husky defense has to be really proud of that performance and playing with some farther members down on the depth chart, too, with injuries to the secondary and suspensions.
Yeah, Brandon Bigelow stepped in and did a nice job. Really kind of a capper to 2 excellent years for Justin Wilcox. Sad to see him going to USC as well.
Yeah. Not particularly excited about that one. But the defense played great. The offense played adequate, good enough against a really good defense. to win the game, and it was a nice win. You know, it doesn't, I don't think it means much long term, especially since we're talking about all the staff basically being gone, and the whole franchise is kind of starting over.
But it's a feel-good performance for the guys who are going out with it. Obviously, Keith Price getting his first bowl win in three tries to complete a really terrific senior season and career. But then also Austin Seferian Jenkins announcing that he's going pro after scoring a touchdown early in the game.
Yeah, that was nice for ASJ to get that touchdown in that game and to cap off his UW career. We'll probably talk more as we get closer to the draft about ASJ.
And potentially Bishop Sankey, who has that decision coming up for himself after scoring two touchdowns.
But it was a nice win, and it sets a new benchmark for Chris Peterson coming in. Of 9 wins is the standard that we're going to expect going forward.
The other thing I liked about the game is that it was kind of a changing of the guard within the course of the game. We saw this a few weeks ago with the Oregon State game, too, but Keith Price gets knocked out with a rib injury. Sankey had a hand injury and was on the sidelines in the fourth quarter. And other than ASJ being in there, it was basically the unit that you're going to see next year with Siler Miles at quarterback, Jesse Callier playing running back, and a really talented group of receivers. That's the other thing. No Casey Williams, he'll be back. But DeMaurier Stringfellow had a nice game, 4 catches for 36 yards. And John Ross showed his talent at times.
Well, with the kick return especially.
Had a carry for 11 yards. And I think really just a kind of like a transition point, a look at what's to come.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool that happened at the end of the game. And it'll be really exciting to see what Chris Peterson can do with that talent that he has there and how they can develop Siler Miles even more. Siler Miles, not a great passer at this point, but they still have a lot of work to do with him. But I think it'll be really interesting to see what they do with him going forward and if he is going to be the starting quarterback next year.
Well, I think he's definitely earned. You know, I mentioned a few weeks ago on the podcast, I think probably just because of the coaching change that everything will be up in the air, but in our minds, certainly, he comes in as the very heavy favorite to win that job. And he struggled throwing the ball in that game, as he has a couple of times he's come in relief. But he did show that other dimension that he brings to the offense, 2 carries for 30 yards. So, you know, all in all, a feel-good win. The coaching staff announced today Jonathan Smith will be the offensive coordinator. Not a lot of surprises other than that. Everyone who is on the staff has worked with Coach Pete at Boise State at some point, although not all of them coming directly there at the moment.
Would have liked to see some synergy within the coaching staff, especially from the player standpoint, so that it's not a whole new group of people that they might not know coming in. Coach Pete may have recruited some of the players who are here right now. But at the same time, I think you want, and I think that'll be the criticism of Coach Peterson, that he didn't keep anybody around. But at the same time, when you have the guy, who's the guy? You know, it's not like we're hiring a new coach who doesn't know what they want. Yep. You want Chris Peterson who's comfortable with the people who he's working with. You want Chris Peterson, we know, can evaluate talent among coaches and players, and we want him to have the coaches that he feels really confident working with.
Yeah, and I think he's established relationships with these guys. That, again, there's a continuity and a familiarity even as they come into a new situation. So it'll be really interesting. Now the next task becomes recruiting. We got about a little over a month until signing day, and
I'm excited to look at that. There's not the same kind of pressure on this class that there would be on a different class, since it's expected to be kind of a smaller one. The pressure on it is just because it's Chris Peterson, but I think what we really need to look at is the 2015 signing day. And that's what we'll be looking forward to. I think that the 2014 season will be more important than the 2014 signing day is, partially because of all those players already being here. We're not looking for a new quarterback. We're not looking for a new running back. We're not looking for new wide receivers. You know, tight end might be an area where they need to find somebody to help plug in. But a lot of the team is already set.
And it's a tough situation. You're playing catch-up when you come in as a staff this late. I think the big thing that I'm going to look for is where they recruit and the types of players they recruit. I think we're going to start to get a sense for what Coach Pete and his staff, their philosophy will be in terms of talent at a Pac-12 school.
Okay, so let's get into the, I guess, what we'll call the main event. At the beginning of the season, we went through, and full disclosure, this happened the night of the Thursday night game, which opened the season, which was Baltimore at Denver, and Denver had kind of just destroyed Baltimore in that game. So we went through and looked at the over-unders, I think from LVH, from Las Vegas Hilton, and then picked over-unders for all the NFL teams throughout the season. We were probably feeling very confident at the time.
I was feeling very confident, but I hope I wasn't.
And this is partially out of curiosity to see how we did, partially to see if this is something that we should be betting on in Vegas in the future. I vowed that the week before the NFL season next year, I'm going to Vegas, even if I have to go by myself, and I'm going to put all sorts of money down on things.
You've seen the results of these?
I'm curious. This might sway me. I'm still going, no matter what, because I am gambling crazy in that week. Desperate for gambling. So we're going to go through the teams there in alphabetical order, and we'll see how we did. It'll be a bit of a competition between us to see how we did.
Are you keeping count, or should I keep count?
I'll keep count. I'll put little X's over here. So anyway, we start with Arizona. Their over-under was 5.5. And again, just to understand, half games means... that if they would have won 5 games, they would have been under. If they would have won 6 games, they would have been over. Ties count as losses in this scenario. So Arizona at 5.5, we both picked under.
Wow, I really don't like Carson Palmer.
And they ended up winning 10 games, neither of us got that one. Atlanta, their over-under was 10 even, and we both picked them to win 10 games. Again, they did not win 10 games.
And they won 4.
They won 4.
They fell just short.
So there's some big goose eggs for us there. Baltimore at 8.5, we both picked over.
Even after watching them lose.
I think we almost intentionally picked over because we'd watched them lose. And we both picked over and they won 8 games. So we're 0-3 so far. And Buffalo, 6.5, we both picked under and they won 6 games. There's a win.
Hey, we're on the board.
So that's nice. We're tied at 1 right now. We picked really similar in a lot of these. Carolina at 7, they're over-under 7. We both picked over and they won 12. So that was a nice job by us.
Warden our faith in Ron Rivera even before he became Riverboat Ron.
And I think that we both believed in Carolina heading into the season and thought that they were one of the best teams in the NFL.
Without question.
And that was why after week one when they played so poorly against the Seahawks that it was almost shocking. It was like, Ron Rivera needs to go if this is going to be their team because they've got a really good team here.
They played that poorly? They nearly won?
Well, I mean, they scored 7 points.
I mean, they also were driving for the potential go-ahead score and had an untimely fumble. So, I don't know. I disagree with that. Now, when they lost to Buffalo on the other hand, then I was like,
they got destroyed at Arizona when we thought Arizona wasn't necessarily that good of a team also.
Yeah.
So, Chicago, 8.5 was their over-under. I picked over, you picked under, and they won 9 games. So, that's a victory for me there.
That was a close one.
Cincinnati was 8.5.
Yeah, we were on already a Bengals high after watching
Hard Knocks.
Yeah.
So we both picked over and got that one. They won 11 games this year. Cleveland, their over-under was 6. I was really high on Cleveland heading into the season.
That was a big source of debate between the two of us.
I actually thought Cleveland was going to make the playoffs. There was a pretty big fight between us about their quality. I thought that Cleveland's defense was really good. And for some reason, I was led to believe that Brandon Whedon was a competent NFL quarterback. And I thought Trent Richardson would be a breakout star this year.
I knew correctly that Brandon Whedon was not an NFL quarterback. I feel good about that one.
So their over-under was 6. I bet even. You bet under, and they won 4 games, so that's one for you. Tied right now at 4-4 through Cleveland. And then Dallas, 8.5, a team that I always cheer for no apparent reason. Their over-under was
8. It's self-loathing.
8.5. Last night, if Kyle Orton wouldn't have romoed it at the end of the game... they would be over. Unfortunately, they're under. You bet the under. I bet the over, so that's one for you. And you take the lead 5-4.
Nice little run here for me.
Yeah, pretty exciting. Denver, I think we both picked under on this one, partially because we've just seen them win and didn't want to be biased.
Yeah.
But Denver's over-under was 11.5. We both picked under on that one. they won 13, so that's nothing for either of us. And after that game, it looked like Denver was going to go undefeated.
It did.
Peyton Manning had just thrown 6 touchdowns, or did he get to 7?
7.
7 touchdowns in that game. Detroit, their over-under was 8, and I picked over and you picked under. That team really imploded at the end of the season, leading to the firing of Jim Schwartz. And so that's another one for you, man. I hate when you win things.
What a nice run here.
And you're doing pretty
good. It's about to come to an end, however. I see these next two.
Green Bay at 10.5. We both picked over. I think this might have been an over had Aaron Rodgers not gotten injured.
Yeah.
But he had. We both picked over and they were at 8 wins. So that's nothing for either of us. This is an exciting one.
This is maybe our worst of.
Houston at 10.5. It looked like there was so little competition in their division that Houston would easily win 11 games.
Instead, they went 2-14. One pick.
We picked them doing at least 11 games. Both of us, they won 2, and we were 9 games off.
Now, here's a thought question for you. If Machop doesn't throw that interception to Richard Sherman, and they go on to win that game, how many games do they win?
I don't think it's that much more.
I think their season is entirely different if Machop doesn't throw that interception.
That's why Richard Sherman should be the defensive player of the year. For destroying Houston's season.
Yeah.
Destroying Matt Schaub as a human being.
If you like the number one pick in Houston,
long term, if I had to make a bet here, Houston, I think they're a prime candidate for the over next year. I think they're really similar to Kansas City from this last year. They're a good team, and they have a lot of good things set in place, but just had a really terrible season all around. Things just went wrong for them.
I would agree with that.
So we get nothing there on that one. Indianapolis, we were both really down on Indianapolis because we're not very smart. Over-under was 8, and they ended up with 11 victories. Again, that's nothing for us. I'm noticing a sad trend here. Jacksonville, the over-under was 5. I bet under, you bet even, and they won 4 games.
Man, Gus Bradley almost pulled it out for me.
Kansas City, we both bet the over. That was 7.5. This was pretty much the most obvious bet of the whole year, I felt.
Easiest money on the table.
It was pretty clear that Kansas City was going to be a good team. They didn't really surprise anybody. And I think Houston's going to be the same way next year, especially if they draft somebody like Teddy Bridgewater, who looks NFL ready.
I mean, I assume that there was a lot of money. The one thing we didn't take into account was whether there was action on the over or the under here. But obviously, some people didn't see it coming
you
if their line was 7.
Definitely having to pay for the over.
Okay.
Because they try not to. They set it originally and then wait what the action is. And then they'll just pay you less out rather than adjusting the line. Yeah, they don't like having multiple lines out there. So Miami, the over-under was 8. We both bet under and they won 8. So congrats to Vegas for getting the even.
But not congrats to the Dolphins because their season was miserable.
Minnesota, this was the other kind of easy bet for the year. 7.5.
I like how you say this, even though when you went to Vegas, none of those were the ones you actually played.
I know, I bet Indianapolis, and I lost $44.
Burn that ticket.
But Minnesota, 7.5, we both bet under, and they won 5, so we get that one. New England, this was an interesting one. The over-under was 11, we both bet under, and they ended up winning 12.
Despite massive injuries, really gutty performance by the Patriots.
They got really lucky to win 12 games.
They lost a lot of their share of close games. They just played a lot of close games.
Not a 12-win team. New Orleans, the over-under was 9. I felt like they felt like a pretty obvious over. We both bet over. They won 11 this year. I've gotten nothing that you haven't gotten lately. I'm 1 down right now, correct?
Oh, but you're going to get this one.
New York Giants, the over-under was 9. The NFC East was a really difficult division to predict this year. Every single team could have been over or under. There was no obvious for that one. They all could have won 8 games. So the over-under was 9. I bet under, you bet even, and they won 7. So there's one for me, and we're tied up now, right?
Yeah. I'm surprised by this one. The New York Jets are next up. Their line was 6.5, and we both went under. I actually felt pretty positive about the Jets going into the season because I thought people were sleeping on how good Rex Ryan's defenses were.
I thought Rex Ryan was going to get fired halfway through the year. It looks like he'll be coming back next year.
So they won 8. They went over that easily. Although their Pythagorean record, I think, was like 4 wins.
Oakland, a really strange over-under. 5.5, that would have been a pretty good season for Oakland. We both bet under, and they won 4.
I feel like Oakland exceeded my expectations, and they won 4 games.
They were an exceptional 4-win team. This was one that I really screwed up. Philadelphia was 7.5. I bet under, you bet over. I don't really know why I bet under. I thought that the Eagles would make the playoffs. It was one of those things where maybe I'm remembering this incorrectly, but I swear that the Eagles were going to make the play. I thought the Eagles were going
to
make the playoffs.
An official Fabulous Peltoncast shout out to Chuck Klosterman. I don't know if I can find this on the internet, but before the season on the BS report, he predicted that they would go like 3-1 to start the season, then lose like 5 games in a row, and then rip off a bunch of wins at the end of the season once Chip Kelly got adjusted to the NFL. And that is precisely what happened.
Yeah, that was pretty exceptional.
Spot on.
You know, the thing about Philadelphia was their offense wasn't that strange by the end of the year. I was watching them last night, and they didn't look like a strange college-style offense. They basically looked like a pretty good pro-style offense who runs the ball a little bit more than the average team.
To me, the story of the season for the Eagles was their offense, obviously, was amazing, but the fact that their defense ended up playing as well as it did
was
really what
set
them apart.
Defense really carried them for a lot of the season. Then
I don't know about a lot of the season.
Pittsburgh, whose over-under was 9, and we both bet over on that one, and we don't get that one either. They won 8. Wow, we are bad at this.
They looked pretty good for stretches there.
San Diego was 7.5. We both bet under, and they won 9, so we don't get that one either. I thought we were going to do a lot better.
Again, kids, don't spend your money gambling.
San Francisco, the over-under was 11. We both bet under, and they won 12.
Yeah.
So there you go. Seattle, the over-under was 10.5. I bet under. I'm pretty sure I bet that just, you know, being conservative. I don't want to get ahead of myself. The schedule looked really tough. I bet under, you bet over, so you obviously get that one. They won 13. St. Louis, the over-under was 7. How did St. Louis not... Oh, God.
I'm really taking a commanding lead here.
St. Louis, their over-under was 7.5. I bet the over for St. Louis. They looked really good. They're an 8-win team.
I think they're a 7-win team.
You bet under and they won 7, so you get that one also. Tampa Bay, we both bet the over of 7.5. Tampa Bay was another team who I was pretty confident would make the playoffs.
Gonna blame Bill Barnwell and Robert Mays for that one.
They were really, really confident about Tampa Bay, and I bought into that. And they won 4, so they were 3.5 games worse. Tennessee, God, we're so stupid. Man.
I mean, yeah.
Tennessee, the over-under was 6.5, and we both bet the under, and they won 7.
Oh, man, I think this might actually be a worse prediction for me than Houston.
And then we close it out with Washington. Their over-under was 8.5. I bet under. Fortunately, I get one. You bet over. You thought Washington would win 9 games. I'm telling you, the NFC East was really hard to predict. And they won 3. So we can.
It's really hard for me to predict.
With what did I get here? I ended up with 11 out of 32. And you ended up with 13 out of 32. Okay, so maybe I shouldn't spend money in Vegas.
Absolutely, you should not. At least not on this.
That was really bad.
But
we did much worse than I thought we would. I'm happy that we did this exercise. Maybe I'll talk some sense into myself, but probably not. Around this time of year, I'm so excited about gambling. Everything seems obvious.
In the same way in fantasy sports at the start of the year, everything seems obvious.
Well, it does. It is obvious for me.
So that's what we're going to recap to wrap things up here.
Yeah, so let's look at the 2013 fantasy season. It was probably overall the year that the running back kind of died in fantasy football. Toward the end of the season, that trend might have switched, but wide receivers really became, if you have that flex position, you're probably going wide receiver there. And there were some wide receivers who had some monster years. But so we wanted to look at our fantasy football awards for the season.
Yeah, I think let's start out with most valuable fantasy player.
Okay, I went with Jamaal Charles.
I went with Josh Gordon.
Josh Gordon.
So I think that it depends whether you're taking into you're staying strictly their value to your team or whether you're also taking into account value relative to where they were drafted. I ended up getting Josh Gordon in our league in the 13th round.
Okay, that was really nice. That was a nice pick.
That was pretty incredible.
I was kicking myself
number one
on drafting for not drafting Josh Gordon. I mean, Jamaal Charles was picked at number 10, so he's the last pick of the first round. He ended up being about 11 points more than replacement level for a running back, which was a huge difference. He was the best running back and the best non-quarterback. If you had Jamaal Charles, you had, along with LeSean McCoy, basically the only two particularly reliable running backs in all of fantasy football.
Yeah, I put McCoy because I think he went in the second round.
Did you put him as...
I put him number 3 on my MVP rankings.
Charles also had the 51 in the playoffs.
Yeah.
So if you're in the playoffs with him, there's a good chance that you won having that huge number. Who was your number 2?
My number 2 was Nick Foles.
Nick Foles.
And your number 2?
Peyton Manning.
So here's my argument. Over the last 8 weeks of the season, after he came back from injury, Nick Foles averaged 24.6 points per game. Over the entire season, Peyton Manning averaged 25.6 points per game. So I think they were similar in terms of overall value down again in the second half, except that Nick Foles was on the waiver wire in your league, and Peyton Manning was probably a second round or maybe first round pick.
Yeah, I thought being picked at number 19 with that consistency throughout the whole season was really good. I mean, I had Nick Foles on my team at one point and actually dropped him, and you claimed him. I may have never started him. I might have never started him over Russell, but I feel stupid for doing that.
And we talked about, I think last week, a lot of teams that had Nick Foles won the championship, and somehow I had the top 2 on my MVP ballot and did not make
the
playoffs.
Must be biased, the top 2 in your own MVP ballot. Yeah, I had a lot of conversations with people about fantasy football, and every single one of them was in the playoffs with the people I was talking to and had Nick Foles.
I don't know how I pulled this off. I had really good running backs, too. I don't get it. I don't know how my team is
just
so bad.
I was saying that if we could pinpoint why you're bad at fantasy football and I'm good, we could really be onto something there.
If I could pinpoint it, I would change it.
My number 3 was Jimmy Graham.
Yeah, I mean, certainly having that kind of weapon at tight end, a huge advantage week after week.
He scored almost 100 or over 100 points more than the 8th best tight end who would be starting for one team out there. And I got him at number 32 in the draft, and having somebody you can consistently put in. He also missed a game, so you could have filled in with somebody else there.
All right, how about moving on, Rookie of the Year?
My Rookie of the Year was Eddie Lacy.
I also went with Lacy. A pretty good year for rookies in fantasy, I would say.
The debate between the two different possibilities for Rookie of the Year was pretty similar to the NFL Rookie of the Year debate between Lacy and Keenan Allen.
I mean, I think Keenan Allen's more valuable in real life than he was in fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, Eddie Lacy had 11 touchdowns this year. He basically scored a touchdown almost every game that he played. And that was what really made him a monster fantasy play. He ended up number 6 overall for running backs and was drafted much lower than that.
With so many useful rookie running backs, always a favorite of mine. I had both Le'Veon Bell and Gio Bernard on my team, but also Zach Stacy came up to be a big contributor.
Yeah, Zach Stacy and Andre Ellington were pretty good. The thing about rookie running backs is I think that they've become overrated, especially in our league, or at least in our league, because of the success that they've had in the past. They've been underrated for so long that they became overrated.
I mean, I think it's mostly the two of us that are battling for them a lot of the time, although neither of us ended up with Eddie Lacy.
And do you want to do the fantasy defensive player of the year?
Well, I picked the Chiefs. I went with team, and, you know, especially for a team that went undrafted defensively in our league, they had a pretty awesome season. They did not end up being the 85 Bears of fantasy football as you projected at midseason.
They had a few negatives in there. I went with Richard Sherman as the player, and I just like saying that Richard Sherman is the defensive player of the year. And then also the Seahawks in general, they had 11 games of 10-plus points. I mean, they were another player that you would expect success from throughout the week. Their only real bad game was at San Francisco, where they had a 2. And Sherman, especially with those interceptions at the end of the year, picking off Eli Manning so many times and Carson Palmer, propelled you into the fantasy playoffs.
Yep.
Okay, what about the biggest bust of the year?
Biggest bust of the year, I went with David Wilson after you mentioned him.
Okay, I went with Ray Rice.
Let me point out that week one of the season, we went into the Sunday night games. I was down by, like, I don't know, 15 points. It looked like it was unlikely because my opponent had David Wilson and I had Victor Cruz, and I needed him to be dramatically better. And Victor Cruz ends up catching like an 80-yard touchdown pass, and David Wilson fumbles and gets benched for the game.
Fumbled twice,
yeah.
He got a -3.
Yeah.
And his whole life ended after that.
I mean, that's a pretty disappointing. When you draft a guy, I think he was the 3rd-round pick, and he gives you a negative and causes you to lose in week one, that's a disappointment.
It was really strange. I was high on both of the Giants running backs, David Wilson and Andre Brown. I drafted Andre Brown. I didn't draft David Wilson. Andre Brown was injured for a significant part of the season before the season even started, and then David Wilson's whole career imploded right before him in week one. I went with Ray Rice. He was picked number 2 in our league, which is probably a little bit higher than most leagues, but he was generally considered a first-round pick.
True.
He averaged 6.7 points per game, which is basically replacement level. Since you drafted him so high, you're more likely to play him. He also played in all 16 games, so it wasn't like you got to play somebody else during that time period, and ended up with only 4 touchdowns throughout the season, 2 of which were in one game.
A lot of disappointing first-round running backs this year. Also, you drafted Doug Martin. We're very excited about that. He obviously got injured but was not playing that well before that, and the backup Tampa Bay running backs ended up being a lot more effective than he was. And then Trent Richardson was a first-round pick, if you'll remember, all the way back when.
He was pick number 11.
Okay, early second round.
First pick of the second round. But Trent Richardson was terrible. He was somebody who I was considering. I mean, Arian Foster had some good games before he was injured, but really all around, running backs at the top of the draft played pretty poorly.
Did you do most improved?
Oh, I didn't do most improved.
I think there's an obvious choice for that.
Who's that?
Nick Foles. And I also did coach of the year.
Who was that?
Chip Kelly.
Chip Kelly was really revolutionized that Eagles offense. Chip Kelly was really exciting. Week one on that Monday Night Football game that the Eagles played in, I was like, thank God I have LeSean McCoy.
That's like one of the most memorable football regular season games, I think, that didn't involve the Seahawks that I have ever had. It just was so awesome the way that they completely lived up to the hype in every single way for that game.
And my most improved would definitely be LeSean McCoy, though. LeSean McCoy, I mean, speaking of the Eagles offense, he had an injury-riddled season last season and then came back and was the second-best running back all year. LeSean McCoy had an awesome season, was consistent throughout the whole season, and really carried me.
It's more like comeback player of the year.
Comeback player of the year. So then we also want to talk about 2014 and our sleepers for 2014, players who were good this year but might be better next year, players who will be targeting next year. Remember this if you're in our fantasy league.
Yes. Just turn it off now. Let's start at running back. I had a couple of guys, the aforementioned Doug Martin and then Alfred Morris. So I'm big on guys who are going to regress to the mean. And Alfred Morris actually had a really fine season, I think.
Alfred Morris is somebody I consider.
Just got overshadowed by the fact that his team was so epically disastrous and awful. And the other thing is Mike Shanahan getting fired. Everyone knows Mike Shanahan hates fantasy players. And hopefully whoever's replacement is will not hate fantasy players.
I heard a lot of talk about who could potentially be the next head coach of Washington. And the talk generally seems to be that they'll probably build a really great run game around RG3 and Alfred Morris, which is what Washington had last year, and this year kind of lost its way.
Yeah.
My number one was Monte Ball. Monte Ball was somebody who came in this year with really high expectations. He was pretty much the only Broncos running back drafted in fantasy football, and then Knowshon Moreno ended up being their main back. This is with the assumption that Monte Ball can learn how to pass block, and that Peyton Manning and he will become comfortable with each other.
And learn how to not fumble.
If those things happen, Monte Ball will be top 5 fantasy running back.
The Jowan is obviously there. Do you have any other running backs?
I also had Donald Brown. Assuming that Donald Brown will take over the Colts' starting running back job from the beginning next year, and I think he's a really good running back. I think he's underrated. He's a pretty good pass blocker. They like playing him. Andrew Luck likes playing with him. Yeah. And he had a pretty good end of the season. If he's the guy from the very get-go, I could even see them releasing Trent Richardson.
That's not inconceivable. Good thing they only gave up a first-round pick for him.
Yeah. What else do you have?
All right, at wide receiver, I had Cordarrelle Patterson.
Yeah, I'm jealous of that one.
6 touchdowns in his last 5 games, including the return touchdown yesterday. And then Terrence Williams of the Cowboys didn't really come on over the course of the season, but had a pretty solid rookie year, and I think will be better and a bigger target next year.
Sometimes those Cowboys wide receivers don't develop into the kind of players that you think they're going to.
It's true.
But Cordarrelle Patterson is somebody who I think is going to be a monster next year in fantasy and in the NFL. I was really lamenting that the Seahawks didn't just keep their draft pick and draft him because he's better than Percy Harvin is at this point.
Well, let's see. Percy Harvin, by the way, returning to practice, apparently.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
I had Alshon Jeffrey. He already had a great season, but I'm going to predict right now, Alshon Jeffrey, number one fantasy wide receiver next year.
I mean, that wouldn't stun me. I mean, it's a little tough because he's got such a strong target next to him, whereas guys like Kelvin Johnson and Josh Gordon are really much more clearly the number one guy for their teams. But yeah, if he has another breakout season on top of this, then look out rest of the league.
And then also Kendall Wright. Kendall Wright is somebody who I've been hyping all year. He was 15th in the league in targets. He gets thrown the ball a lot. And I think once that Titans offense, especially if Jake Locker comes back and can build up some accuracy, I think
that's a pretty big if.
And if they get a running game going also and can get some separation for Kendall Wright, he'll become a monster fantasy player. I think he'll probably be a top 10 fantasy player next year, wide receiver.
All right, then I only could come up with one tight quarterback.
Who's that?
RG3.
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, he's going to be much better.
I would expect a huge year from RG3 next year. I think that the whole Washington offense is going to be turned around. I think they're another candidate for a big turnaround next year.
The other guy I looked at was Colin Kaepernick, who was much better in the second half of the season once his receivers got healthy and played an extraordinarily difficult schedule of opposing defenses. I know this because I had him on my team. But it turns out he's going to play an extraordinarily difficult schedule of opposing defenses again next year because the NFC West is just going to be a monstrous division, and they face the AFC West, so you get the Chiefs. I mean, the Broncos were not great defensively, but not a team you're going to score a lot of points against, so I don't think it's going to be that much better for him.
Yeah, with RG3, you get some of the worst defenses in the league, really. I mean, playing the Cowboys twice is really exciting. And I think that he'll be back and he'll have a coach who's steadier. Mike Shanahan, I think, was the problem this year in a lot of ways. And also, he'll be a year removed from the injury.
Yep. Tight end?
I didn't put any tight ends.
Jordan Reed.
No, Jordan Reed, this is the Washington.
Yeah.
They're going to be a good team.
Draft Redskins.
I think that they're going to be a good team. I agree with you. Jordan Reed's a young, athletic tight end. I think he'll be... I mean, Pierre Garçon was obviously their number one target this year. He led the league in targets. But I think that Jordan Reed is going to become a huge target for them next year and a big red zone threat.
All right, well, we close this as always, and this will be the last time we'll check this out. Shout out to Katie. Jermaine Kearse, her last round pick, who she kept over Vic Ballard, and we've been checking in all season long, did not play yesterday due to injury, but still finished the season with... 50 points? Is that right?
That's not terrible.
That's a pretty solid season.
I mean, it's not worth owning on a fantasy team.
No, not at all. And he continues to not have any fantasy value, according to
I like projections. They write that every week.
He had a really nice season as the fourth wide receiver, and then eventually this third wide receiver.
It was a
for the Seahawks.
Great season for Jermaine Kearse.
And I hope for big things for him in the playoffs.
Seeing him in the playoffs.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening.
Thank you.